And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhellman. Each spring, the Environmental Working Group tabulates a laundry list of potential red flags in our food system. Known as the Dirty Dozen, this list lays out produce products, which are most commonly found with pesticide residues. Fruits like strawberries, grapes, apples, cherries, pears, and peaches all on the list. So folks, don't forget to wash your fruit. But according to the test data that supports the EWG's list, more than 90% of samples of strawberries, apples, cherries, nectarines, and veg like leafy greens tested positive for residues of two or more pesticides. And more from the salad bowl, celery, cucumbers, tomatoes, peppers, lettuce, kale, spinach, all on this 2021 Dirty Dozen watchout list. Specifically, the test data behind this list found that trace elements of over 90 pesticides were on lettuce. On your peppers, results of this show that there is residue of 115 different pesticides, 115 different hormone disruptors, neurotoxins, and chemicals, all tooled with the most advanced modern scientific marvels to make pesticides as pungent and persistent as regulations will allow. But according to the test, and based on these regulations, in these commodities tested in the USDA's Pesticide Data Program, which is the public science which sits behind the Dirty Dozen list, less than 1% of all produce had levels above legal limits. Yet, still, volumes of these supercharged chemicals envelop the fruits and vegetables that we feed our families. For some additional clarity to this, the Pesticide Data Program is a collaboration amongst the USDA, EPA, and FDA, and it performs over 10,000 pesticide residue tests per year on foodstuff in the U.S. Sampling from 10 population densities, 87% of these tests are conducted on fruits and vegetables. So I'd say the four questions coming out of that is, and worth considering here is, of the 10,545 tests that were done in 2021, is that a valid sample to assess pesticide residue and impact on all of our foods? Just for some context there, did you know that U.S. orchard growers produce about 30 billion apples a year? 30 billion, that's a sum of 240 million bushels. And farmers spray pesticides sometimes 10 times during a grow season. Yet, how many tests do we do on those apples? And part two of those questions to consider, what about field error or spill factor or misuse or mistaken treatments or lack of knowledge share that aren't even caught up in the small sample set of these federal agency tests? Number three, up to 90% of applied pesticides won't reach their intended target for some conventional farms. These become active ingredients of unintended consequence. And more context there, we're talking about 1 billion pounds of conventional pesticides that are used on U.S. farms. Yikes. The fourth thing to consider, even if this fractional sample set is enough for us to be happy with, there are still 115 pesticides found on your pepper. Aren't you a bit concerned with the impact of these pesticides over time on your health, mental well-being, fertility? And what about the planet or soil vitality or biodiversity loss? And the impact on our creatures and water contamination, even if it is a trace element. Time to take a fresh look at our produce. So joining me to discuss a creative solution to this pesticide problem and to many more issues in ag is the founder and CEO of App Harvest, Jonathan Webb. Hey, Jonathan, how you doing?
How you doing? Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you taking the time. So, I gave you a lead in there about pesticide overuse, and maybe you can share with our audience what you're doing to rid our produce of pesticide products through your different environment for growing.
Well, it's a topic that, you know, we certainly need to dive deeper in as a society as a whole, and it's not a simple topic, and you know, a pesticide is not a pesticide. It's not a pesticide. You know, there's, you know, from a scale of 1 to 100, there's very, very mild treatments, you know, in the 1 to 5 range. And then there's, you know, the nuclear bomb version of pesticides up near the 100. And then there's, you know, when you use them, where you use them, how you use them. And you know, there's the bottom line is there's definitely not enough research into the environmental impacts that it's having on our soil, the impacts it's having on our water, and the impacts it's having on us as people who consume these fruits and vegetables. But you know, I think two of the numbers that stuck out when you were just talking was, you know, that roughly 10 to 11,000 tests are done a year. And, you know, apples alone, you know, produce 30 billion apples a year in the U.S. And, you know, then you look at the imports coming in from the country south of us. So, you know, here at App Harvest, we are a controlled environment agriculture company that's building some of the world's largest CEA facilities to grow fruits and vegetables indoors in a controlled environment year round, using 90% less water than open field agriculture. We get about 30 times yield per acre. And we use integrated pest management. We use good pests to kill bad pests inside of our facility. And it's just an evolution of agriculture. There's not one or, you know, right way to grow a fruit and vegetable. But there's certainly a group of solutions that, you know, hopefully our world can move towards, and what we're doing in a controlled environment is one of those tools that can be used as we have a growing population and climate change that put more pressure on farmers to get higher yields and reliable produce year round.
Yeah, I think that's your tail comment there is key, because you're doing this in Kentucky, right? I mean, and you were just chatting before the conversation, it was 12 degrees in Kentucky. It's kind of tough to grow things in a normal environment. But through your model, you can have consistency. You can have year-round supply of this healthier, more robust veg that can be harvested nearly same day and sourced to your consumer base. How much of that is a game changer here, that we're not shipping things thousands upon thousands of miles and harvested months or weeks before they should to mature in the truck coming over, but you're really getting this vibrant, nutrient-dense food right from your backyard?
My background was in energy before App Harvest, was a part of building large-scale solar, and we've seen energy in the U.S. really disrupted over the last few decades with a move from fossil fuel to renewable energy. Agriculture, you know, the last great technological revolution that hit American farming, you could argue, is when the tractor was introduced. And then you look at, you know, supply lines themselves, and, you know, why are we growing leafy greens in California and shipping them? You said you were north of Boston. You know, why are we growing them in California and shipping them to Boston? You know, why are we growing food in Mexico, shipping it up to Boston, when we can be using infrastructure, using technology, and building facilities to grow fruits and vegetables year round? So here in Kentucky, that's what we're doing. It was, you know, Kentucky's been known as one of the largest coal mining states in the U.S., Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia. And, you know, one of the reasons coal thrived in this area was because you were able to get to 70% of the U.S. in a one-day drive. So if you kind of look at Moorhead, Kentucky on a map and then zoom out, you'll see that we can drive up to Detroit, down to Atlanta, over to St. Louis, over to Washington, D.C., all within a day's drive, and everywhere in between and further, you know, further beyond that. So having a resource here that you can push out to communities and push out to consumers is the concept. And we've, you know, we're building large scale infrastructure, growing the fruits and vegetables here, focused on bringing production that's in an open field in California and Mexico further to the markets on this side of the country. And then we're doing it, again, using far less land, far less water, and using integrated pest management instead of the harsh, heavy chemical pesticides that you referred to in the opening.
It's a bit of the jelly of the month club here, right? You give us the gift that keeps on giving, and the fact that you had mentioned Kentucky's coal country, right? And there's a changing space in the evolved energy and alternative space. And what I was reading about some of the work you're doing is some of the other net positive elements that you've created with AppHarvest for the community, for jobs creation. What have you seen? What are people telling you about this opportunity that has arisen where there wasn't much prior?
Yeah, it's, you know, people in the environmental community have certainly demonized the coal industry. And I think we need to recognize that 95% of the people working in the coal industry just want to put food on the table, and they want to send their kids to school, and they want a house where they can have their family and have a nice life. That's it. And so if we can offer innovative opportunities in those regions where we've seen the decline of the coal industry, you know, I don't know that there's much more important work that the environmental community can do than to engage with the people that have frankly been victim of the downturn of an industry. And you look at the people working in Central Appalachia, you know, really some of the most economically depressed communities in the country. So you take the one opportunity for a job and you rip it out, and then there was no replacement. So AppHarvest certainly is not a silver bullet, you know, for replacing coal jobs in all these communities. But we do believe the hardest working men and women in the country are arguably the people that powered this country through the Industrial Revolution and provided us with low cost electricity over the last century that we all very much benefited from. And so building this industry in an area of the country that's seen massive decline in the coal industry, we just felt like was the absolute, just from a business perspective, best place to be. And then, you know, working in these communities has been, you know, agriculture itself, if we can't respect people that work on a farm or work to put food on our table, how are we supposed to respect the food that's produced or the environment or anything else? And agriculture is one of those things where it connects all of us. We all eat. It connects us to the land. It connects us to the water we use. But if the people at the center of the production of food and agriculture products aren't being treated fairly, then how do we expect to treat the environment properly or have any respect for the food that's being produced? So here at AppHarvest, everybody makes a living wage. Everyone has full healthcare benefits. Everyone has equity in the company. And I was told that was a pretty radical idea in agriculture. We're making it work, and we're selling to some of the largest grocers in the U.S., Walmart, Costco, Kroger. We're selling to Wendy's. So my take is, you know, if we're doing it in 2021, why, you know, it's great to have these conversations about the environment, but if we can't respect people first and then try to look towards the environment, we're never going to get to the environment. I mean, it just won't happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our take would be in 2021, you know, every agriculture worker should be making a living wage, period, hard stop. And if you're going to have the opportunity to sell fruits and vegetables or food at large at the largest grocers in the U.S., and you're going to have access to the largest economy in the world, then let's make sure that the people producing that food make a living wage. And if we start to do that and we start to create circular, you know, level of respect for everyone in the food and agriculture community, then those same people will be the people that will in turn start to look out for the land, for the water, you know, for the environment, for the way in which we grow the food. But if we don't even treat people with respect that grow the food, then let's give up on anything else, because we're not gonna make it past step one. And so for us, you know, being in Central Appalachia, treating people with respect, creating an opportunity, those are the people that are really gonna change the agriculture industry. It's not me and five other people. It's gonna take, you know, hundreds and thousands of people, frankly. And we need all those people to be a part of this process with us. And in order to do that, let's at least create, you know, an opportunity where they can create a pathway for themselves and have a good, decent life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Rich comments there. I mean, I like your analogy and parallel between the coal miners and producers, because often we talk a lot with aspirational producers here on our show, and often we wag the finger too much at conventional producers who were completely have just done what they have been asked to grow fence row to fence row and to, you know, get bigger, get out. And the game is changing, and I think there are now opportunities, and we need creative economic models. And to your point, getting to this circular economy where people can embrace those values of food systems and treat people fairly and engage in environmental discussions. It's a process, and it's a process of evolving systems thinking, and it's a process of providing food stuff. I think that's one of the best places we got for the circular economy, because you empower the consumer 3 times daily to vote with their dollar for things that they care about. And I'm sure you've seen it now, you're hiring all these folks, and I have too, just being in the space for so long, the volumes of people getting into it, they surely care about these things. They are a value-based generation of folks that are looking for more environmental consciousness, social consciousness, and obviously food is quite a mechanism to get us there.
That's important. I mean, you definitely said vote with your dollar, and I we look at the news or you look at social media and you feel helpless. And, you know, I think we all forget that every day we have buying power, and that buying power collectively is more powerful than any vote at any election. And yes, I mean, I every day try to say forget App Harvest. You could buy App Harvest produce, but, you know, as large as we are, and we're pretty large operators, you know, we're small in scale to the overall agriculture industry, you know, but people every day should be just inquisitive about what food are they putting on their family's plates, you know, what food are they putting into their body, see where it comes from, see who produces it, and is that something you really want to support? And it's not that difficult. It actually, you know, can be quite simple and doesn't need to cost you, you know, exponentially more to be able to feed your family or yourself. So, you know, it's we're right there with you on voting with your dollar. And again, the work we're doing to create jobs here in this region, take care of water, and create a good, healthy product that people can put in their body and feel good about, you know, that all comes down to a consumer voting with their dollar. We put a lot of complex work in on the back end, but, you know, a consumer looking and going, do I want to take this tomato that might have 18 different chemical pesticides on it and potentially child labor or forced labor on, which the LA Times 2 weeks ago just came out with an article about, again, the U.S. having stopped imports from Mexico due to forced labor. Yeah. I mean, that's what you're supporting when you're buying this stuff that you don't know where it's coming from. And the conscious consumer can change all this overnight. It really comes down to the American consumer voting with their dollar.
Yeah, great empowerment message for consumers and for your area. And here, a quick blurb of your bio just to cue up the next question here. A Kentucky native, Jonathan Webb, has long been committed to sustainability and job creation in Appalachia. Now, after years of study and gathering support for inside and outside the region, he's turned his dream to high-tech farming hub in Appalachia into a reality with App Harvest. So you are from Kentucky originally. There's a lot of interesting food roots in the bluegrass state. Maybe you can share with our audience, what was your influence to get into agriculture in the first place? You told us the evolution of how, you know, professionally you went from energy into this, but, you know, was it a grandma? Was it a restaurant in the local area? What sparked the interest in food?
For me, it did start with, you know, growing up in Kentucky. I went to public schools. I went to our public university, and just consider myself that somebody as a kid that was always, you know, curious and, you know, somewhat aware, and didn't have any real professional training and energy. And that's where I spent about a decade of my career in solar. And then, you know, really food is just another form of energy, right? So when you're building a solar project, you're creating electrons, and those electrons go on the power grid. And for me, it really started with the problem, and then zoomed down. And so many of the problems facing us today can be solved through the food we eat. You know, whether it's, you know, environmental degradation of our soils, environmental degradation of our waterways, the toxic chemicals we're putting into our body, you know, what that's doing to our body. And then ultimately, you know, you look at growing population and climate disruption. We have to produce more food with less stability of the climate. And the UN has predicted we would need 50 to 70% more food by 2050. Today, we use 70% of fresh water for agriculture production. So do the math. How do you get 70% more out of something when you're already using 70% of the freshwater resource? And then that's when I took my skills of just building stuff, which was large solar, and moving over to controlled ag. And yeah, I always loved fresh food. I always loved plants, Wendell berries in Kentucky. Always admired the Four Season organic farmer, but never had any great training in it. And I had a grandmother that grew up in Whitley County, which was Eastern Kentucky, and, you know, just loved cooking and was always a bit of aware of what food was and where it came from. But what I didn't realize was just how, and I know many of us kind of hear it and you might see the headline, but just how completely broken our food system is in the U.S. It's a flaming disaster. And, you know, you look at 50 years out, 30 years out, 20 years out, are we going to look at food companies today like the cigarette companies of the 1960s or 70s? Quite possibly, right? And you walk into a grocery store, 80% of what's in a grocery store is not food. You know, it's some processed thing that has tons of chemicals in it. So, you know, being able to use, again, skills I had to build large infrastructure and use technology, understanding that there was an opportunity to build here in this region and grow a fruit and vegetable better and offer real food solutions. And then here at AppHarvest, we've tried to make it from the onset. We don't want to raise prices for the average everyday American. You know, I come from a family where we went to fast food restaurants. My dad loved Waffle House, and we'd go to Waffle House. In many cases, American families are just worried about putting food on the table. I know that's hard for a lot of people to realize, but, you know, a vast majority of American households are living paycheck to paycheck, and we cannot raise food prices, but we can use technology and we can use innovation to offer better food solutions and offer real food. And it's going to be a toggle. So for us at AppHarvest, we set out day one, you know, we want to replace dirty imports coming into this country that are layered with 20 different chemical pesticides. In many cases, child labor is on the farms, forced labor is on the farms. You have no clue where this stuff is coming from south of the border. And that's our competition. But we don't want the American consumer to pay more because we know they don't have the luxury to do that. And that's why we intentionally, you know, went with scale. So build really big and try to get unit economics. But ultimately do all this to where we can do it in a way where we're offering a premium product to what's conventionally available, you know, but do it at or around the same price. And then being able to do it in the home where I grew up has been really a dream come true and the start of our journey over the next couple of decades. But doing it here has been really important to many of us who helped start this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes you just need things smothered at Waffle House. I get it. I mean, you got to go in there and it's going to enjoy that every once in a while. And
smothered, covered. You got it.
You got it. I mean, right. You can't miss out on that. And I think to the point of every, you know, eating is an agricultural act, according to Wendell Berry, which I completely agree with, which is the storyline, like what you're kind of told is, you know, as eaters, we should all be engaged in agriculture. And boy, I did spend some time in Kentucky. It is a beautiful spot, and I can understand the inspiration. About a dozen years ago, I did my own research study with some buddies. We went down to Frankfort and did a full tour, like a weekend tour and some fun around the Buffalo Trace Distillery. You know, I should have bought that full barrel of 23-year-old Pappy Van Winkle. I could actually sold that thing and bought one of those horse farms at this point. But, you know, you got some interesting things. All that water, right? The limestone in the water makes for special things. That's what they told us at the distillery.
That's right. So, you know, we're definitely known for bourbon in the central part of the state, and you know, trying to make ourselves known for fruits and vegetables now going forward. But yeah, come on down and tour the bourbon distilleries in the central part of the state, and come check out, you know, the Willy Wonka of agriculture going on in the hills of the Appalachian Mountains in the eastern part of the state.
That's right. Nothing washes down a good salad with like some 23-year-old bourbon. So I agree with that. Hey, but you know, I did read that your inspiration for this came out of the Netherlands. That you know, this tiny little country the size of Vermont, which is the second largest exporter in the world, and they have 10 times more of a footprint under glass than anywhere else in the world. So is the Westlands your Disneyland?
You know, we as, you know, humans are always standing on the shoulders of those that come before us, right? And in this time of just complete uncertainty on what the future holds, you know, we really need to be looking around the world collectively at where the best ideas are. And, you know, the Netherlands is the premier agriculture producer in the world. You said it, they're a country the size of Vermont, and they're the second largest agriculture exporter in the world, only behind the U.S. It's dumbfounding. And going to tour really the top, you know, universities and producers and technology over there, is it really opens your eyes as to what's possible. And that's, you know, the challenges in front of us are very, you know, yes, it's scary at times, but that challenges the opportunity. And really, are we going to go down a path where it's a post-apocalyptic Mad Max world, or are we going to go down a path that's an Avatar type world where nature meets technology? And there are technologies in the world. At this point, it's about execution at scale, taking and adopting those technologies, and we as humans rapidly evolving to the circumstances of the day. But the Netherlands has been a great, helpful partner with us. Our governor in Kentucky has orchestrated an agreement with the top universities there, our universities here, a lot of information sharing back and forth, and it's been incredibly collaborative. And again, that's where, you know, we as a company have tried to embrace broader stakeholders, both government here, government there, universities here, universities there, to try to figure out how we're going to solve these problems, and really open source the information we're getting. We as an industry player, again, it's less about just us as a company solving these problems. This is an existential threat, you know, to us as a country in the U.S. You know, we talk about energy security all the time. We don't talk about food security, and really us as people. I mean, you look at China and India. China and India have 10% of the world's fresh water. They have 40% of the world's population. How is that going to play out long term? You know, you have to grow a lot more food with a lot less resources. And one thing we haven't really zoomed in on is the water aspect. And, you know, 95% of a fruit and vegetable is water. We're in a region in Kentucky where we've had our wettest decade on state record, three of our wettest years in the past decade. So where California is drying up, you know, Lake Mead drying up, the Colorado River drying up, the southwest of the U.S. drying up, you know, Mexico facing drought year in and year out, there's certain parts of the U.S. where climate change is actually making areas wetter, and Kentucky's one of those. So taking that water, packaging it up into a fruit and vegetable, and then shipping it out is ultimately why we're building the infrastructure here. And again, these types of what we've been doing here, we're trying to be collaborative, both in D.C. with USDA, with the White House, you know, with state government, with here, with our governor here, you know, and we're trying to throw up the flag that, you know, where is the national policy on food? Who is taking lead on this? Not every 2 years a congressman's trying to get reelected, so they're thinking, you know, what are they going to do in the next 6 months to help their constituents so they get reelected? Where's our 10, 20, 30 year outlook on food in the U.S.? Because if you really get around the table and you start to look at where we're at, from, you know, nutrients in the soil being degraded, you know, look at the freshwater reservoirs in California that are being depleted, you know, fossil fuels are not the only extractive industry in the US. Agriculture is absolutely an extractive industry, and we're mining the nutrients out of our soil, and we're depleting water out of our reservoirs that aren't being replenished. And there's no policy anywhere that's looking out for the future generations here in the US. And we've been trying our hardest to get stakeholders at the table, and the Netherlands has certainly been a strong partner with us to help throughout these conversations in the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah, they have a manageable size where they can make these multi-stakeholders work. And I think to your point about the, we need a food plan, we absolutely do, but unfortunately it's deeply vetted, deeply seated and festering a bit as a political football, purely in the fact that it's so connected to SNAP. But I mean, if we had an agricultural infrastructure that we could embrace these innovations coming out, I think it changes the paradigm of the conversation, which I think what you guys are ultimately doing. And in you to your point on water, yeah, you only need a certain amount of water to make enough bourbon for the crew, so you got plenty of it down there. But ultimately, what you're creating, because of the efficiencies that you're creating, because the vast majority of what you can harvest for water is ultimately getting put into the tomato, into the cucumber, whatever the product you're doing, there's a reduction of waste and contamination. Your model is ultimately quite extensible, isn't it? I mean, you can turnkey these things and put them in different regions as you grow accordingly. So what are the plans for expansion? What are the next steps of where you could put another footprint?
It's really a global solution, and we're head down on our headquarters being here. But you know, I was on conversations last night with folks in the Middle East, and we've talked to multiple countries and ambassadors in the Middle East. You know, the Middle East imports almost all of their fruits and vegetables. You know, I mentioned China and India, 10% of the fresh water in the world, 40% of the world's population. So Southeast Asia is certainly in dire need of how do you grow far more with far less. And again, the statistic we talk about, we grow a fruit and vegetable with 90% less water, and we get 30 times yield per acre. So our 60-acre farm in Moorhead, Kentucky, does the equivalent of 2,000 to 2,500 acres in California or Mexico. So you look at, you know, the late, great E.O. Wilson that just passed away. I had the opportunity to meet E.O. Wilson, spoke at the Half Earth Summit in Berkeley a couple of years ago. And you look at it, you know, what Half Earth is doing, trying to preserve land and water for biodiversity. There's no way to get there without making agriculture a huge part of the solution. And if we can find a way to feed, you know, 8 to 9 billion people with using far less land and far less water than we do today, then we can absolutely turn land and water back over to the wild and let the wild do what it does best and bring itself back to life. You know, but we have to use technology. And yes, I you know, this concept of growing in soil using water, we 100%. I eat, you know, I try to eat fruits and vegetables out of a garden around where I live. You know, but you mentioned earlier, it's 12 degrees here in Kentucky today. You have to have a way to grow that's not in your backyard in order to sustain year round. And we think there is a balance between controlled environment agriculture, using technology, using innovation, grow with far less water, far less land, get a lot more production, and couple that with, you know, good organic farming that's localized and community based. Where are we going to be in the years ahead? We're building some of the largest facilities in the world right now in Central Appalachia, and we're focused on the U.S. But you know, we want to be helpful on the global stage, whether that means, you know, us as a company directly going into foreign markets. You know, but the thing that keeps me up the most at night is, you know, again, just the startling numbers of, you know, we need 50 to 70% more food by 2050. I mean, humans have to grow more food between now and 2050 than we have in the last 10,000 years of human existence. That is extreme pressure on our planet. It's extreme pressure on our waters and on our nutrients in our soil. And if we don't create policy at scale or frameworks on how we're going to get there, you know, it's going to be a rough couple of decades ahead. And, you know, the thing that keeps me up at night is how do we get there? And CEA is really the third wave of sustainable infrastructure. And with, you know, renewable energy taking off about two decades ago, electric vehicles taking off with Tesla, you know, 2010 going public. And then, you know, right now we're in our infancy of controlled environment agriculture. And hopefully we can be helpful on the global stage in the years ahead.
Yeah. I mean, no doubt. And, it's a formula or maybe a recipe of how we have to evolve, and kind of a balancing act here, because surely technology is going to play a major role, but to your point about organic farming and better soil management, you know, getting back to Half Earth and E.O. Wilson, the approach is we got to change the way that we're growing food in terrestrial environments and managing our commons in order to have a balanced planet. But technology will have a huge part of that, to your point, because it adds efficiency and proficiency, but not that much technology, because ultimately technology and science also can go too far afield or be corrupted and got us in the spot we're at place, or even in your space of controlled environment growing. And maybe you can share with our audience a bit more about this, that you're using a horizontal footprint, which leverages natural light. You're not a vertical farm, which is making a lot of headway in the news. You're something very different. You don't have to create all the light, all the energy. You're kind of a balancing act between the best of the both worlds. Maybe you can share with the audience what the difference is between vertical farm and horizontal farm and what you get out of that horizontal footprint.
Great distinction. And you know, we at AppHarvest started the company going, you know, nature is the dominant technology. You know, we look, you know, I'm talking to you on an iPhone. You know, we talk about iPhones being technology. You know, nature is technology, and we are clueless. I mean, we have no idea, you know, how trees communicate with each other through, you know, microbes in the soil, or, you know, how quickly plants can evolve and communicate with one another. We're clueless. And so we at AppHarvest wanted to start the company with the concept that we're going to put nature first. We're going to try to harness it as best as possible. And then we're going to use man-made technology, which is frankly rudimentary, and try to push nature from behind. And so again, coming from step one, that being our mindset, we developed then what is the best way we can try to grow a plant, use less water, use less land, you know, get really harsh chemicals out of the growing process. And that's where ultimately we came to what we ended up building here, which is, we grow in a glass structure. So again, you don't have to be an astrophysicist or, you know, a plant soil biologist to understand that what do you need to grow a plant? Well, you need sunlight and you need rainwater. So how about we design a system where the plant grows completely on rainwater? So we have, we run our facility, which is a 60-acre facility, almost 3 million square feet, where we collect all the water on the roof, we put it in a retention pond, and then we filter it only with sand and UV. It goes into our facility. So radical idea. We're going to grow a vegetable with completely rainwater. Then we built a glass structure where, yes, we have LED lights, and we add micromole light to the plant, but first we take the sunlight and we use that sunlight for the plant, and we only add LED light or micromole light to the plant that the sun does not provide. So first we're using the sun, we're only adding artificial light to the plant when the sun isn't shining, and we run completely on recycled rainwater. Then from there, we have a whole host of technologies inside of the facility, robots that are scanning the plant to see if there's a pest or disease. But we're using integrated pest management. Again, what is the best what's the best technology available today? Nature. So how do you best pollinate a plant? You use bees. So we use bees to pollinate our plants. We use integrated pest management, good pest to kill off bad pest. And again, the whole concept of what we're trying to do is, yes, we have robots in our facility. Yes, we use big data. Yes, we have AI constantly analyzing, you know, when to add humidity, when to add heat in sections of the facility. But ultimately, we're doing all that in support of nature and trying to push nature from behind, which to the plant itself, we're just optimizing for that tomato plant, cucumber, strawberry plant, or leafy green to give it an environment and almost trick it, give it a controlled environment year round. So again, inside the facility, that plant is always getting exactly what it wants. You know, whether it's the amount of light, the amount of water, the amount of humidity, the amount of nutrients, and just trying to create an environment. And as you look decades out, you know, as climate disruption continues to plague our planet, that is what's going to make almost an impossible environment for a farmer to predict yields and continue to grow outdoors. I mean, when you have, you know, look here in Kentucky, we had record high heat in December, some of our hottest days ever in December. And today we have some of our coldest days ever in January. So these swings of radical high temperatures, radically low temperatures, drought versus flooding, we have to figure out how to bring that growing environment into controlled environments. And that's where at App Harvest, we've, you know, tried to create a model that is, you know, symbiotic in ways, and really replicates what nature offers.
Very cool. It's, and I think you brought up a key point. Our audience may be less familiar with IPM or integrated pest management, but it really is an approach, right? It's a sequence of practices where you take an approach of managing and monitoring to get to those better outcomes, which are more conducive to healthy environments. So very
and
positive.
And then to go to your point, what is the difference between so CEA is a term we're probably going to start to hear a lot over the decades to come. Mm. And there's a lot of different ways to do it. So vertical farming is in a warehouse where you have, you know, think of a warehouse in Brooklyn, New York, growing leafy greens. The issue with that has been you don't use sunlight and you don't use rainwater. And there's other inputs. So you use all artificial lighting. You have to completely run those lights on electricity that then has environmental impact. You know, you use city water, which has impact on the local waterways that cities use to run a city. So there's going to be different models for different areas of the world. You know, not to say vertical farming might do great in Hong Kong or Tokyo, you know, but a vast majority of the world, you know, you can use glass structures, you can use sunlight, you can use rainwater, then use all the technology. And CEA, Controlled Environment Ag, will be used in a variety of different ways in the world. And there's no one, again, there's no one singular way to do it. But there's different approaches, and those different approaches have pluses and minuses, depending on where you're at and how you're doing it.
Yeah, but... I think there's quite a line of demarcation there with the economics of it, because I've yet to see a economic model for vertical farming to be successful, just because the energy cost. But I'm sure that is the next innovation that will come in iterations, because it will be key. And I think putting them in urban environments, it's equally positive in the fact that people are enthusiastic about food grown so like locally, hyper locally. It's almost when it snows in the city, people go skiing. It's an awareness campaign. So, you know, all positive things. But John, the last question for you here before you go, and this is kind of grounding it back to our consumers, almost start where we began of talking about the environmental working group's Dirty Dozen list. 3 million square feet there. And so what crops are you growing? I know you're growing tomatoes, and I know you make salsa out of that, but what are you growing now? And what will consumers see in the future for other crops coming down the pike?
Yeah, this year, we've got one facility, our flagship facility in Morehead, Kentucky, that's nearly 3 million square feet. This year, we're opening three more facilities, totaling a little under 6 million square feet in total for those three additional facilities. And by the end of this year, we'll be selling strawberries, salad greens, a whole host of variety of tomatoes, and they'll be at the largest grocers and retailers nationally. And for us, we started a campaign last year called Fight the Food Fight. We were selling salsa direct to consumer that uses our tomatoes. But then we thought, you know, let's bring farmers along for the discussion with us. And we've got nine other ingredients in that salsa all from farmers here in the U.S. and you know, we feel are ethically sourced that meet our standards. And the Fight the Food Fight campaign that we've tried to start is really just to say we're all in this together. And whether you're, you know, a conventional farmer today, an open field organic farmer, whether you're a consumer in Brooklyn, New York, or a consumer in Moorhead, Kentucky, you know, let's just be conscious of what food we're putting on our plate. You know, let's have these. We all eat, right? There's the one commonality that we all have in the world. We eat, and we can be having these conversations and at the breakfast table or dinner table. And, you know, we have been having these conversations in the hills of Appalachia. I mean, these futuristic, wild, you know, decade-long thinking of where the world's going is happening in rural communities in Appalachia. And you know, there's a lot more that connects us than divides us. And that one thing that definitely connects us is food. And you know, we just can encourage consumers to fight the food fight. Ask a grocer, where does this come from? Do I know it's ethically sourced? Do I know the people growing it are being treated fairly? Do I know the land's being treated fair? And if we ask those questions, you know, you'll tend to find the answers. And there's a lot of good products available today. It's not just AppHarvest by any means. And the more the consumer engages and the more these conversations happen, you know, the more quickly we're going to evolve our food system here in the U.S. And we're incredibly optimistic. There's tall challenges for the U.S. food system in the decades to come and the global food system, you know, but there's solutions available. And if we're having the conversation, then I think we should all be optimistic on where this can lead.
Creative, very innovative, excellent job of stitching it all together and finding the needs and capitalizing and working on a zeitgeist. I mean, it is happening. It is a food movement. And to your point, I'm too, after speaking with so many experts in the space and the world of food and ag and environmental issues, I too am very optimistic. You know, so Jonathan, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share such insights. I learned a great deal, and I know our listening audience will as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.